press didn't seem to know, or for that matter, care. A community television program did a piece on the guys, filming them at work playing games, but that was about it. Calling the big papers and magazines, Jay found, was fruitless. Instead, Jay, determined to make id's business style as innovative as its games, focused on setting up the company's distribution and marketing. He established a toll-free number to field orders and set up a deal with a fulfillment house. Since they were self-publishing Doom, they would be getting twice the earnings they had on Wolfenstein. Games distributed through the regular retail channels would bleed cash to middlemen. Every time someone bought a game at CompUSA, the retailer would take money, then pay the distributor. The distributor would take money, then pay the publisher. The publisher would take money, then pay the developer. By going shareware, id was cutting them all out, taking 85 cents for every dollar sold. The game would be listed at around $40. Jay figured Doom, like Wolfenstein, would rely on word of mouth. While big guns like Nintendo were spending millions on marketing and advertising, id would take out only one small ad in a gaming magazine for Doom. The goal then was to get the Doom shareware into as many hands as possible. At the time, retail stores were selling shareware discs and being forced by the authors to cough up a high royalty. id, which had made some of the most successful shareware games yet, had a different approach. Give the Doom shareware to retailers for free, no fee, no royalty, and let them keep all the profits from the sale. The more shareware was distributed, the more potential customers id would be able to collect. "We don't care if you make money off this shareware demo," Jay told the retailers. "Move it. Move it in mass quantities." The retailers couldn't believe their ears. No one had ever told them not to pay royalties. But Jay was insistent. "Take Doom for nothing. Keep the profit. My goal is distribution. Doom is going to be Wolfenstein on steroids, and I want it far and wide. I want you to stack Doom deep. In fact, I want you to do advertising for it, too, because you're going to make money off it. So take this money that you might have given me in royalties and use it to advertise the fact that you're selling Doom." Jay got plenty of takers. The buzz around Wolfenstein and Doom brought back old characters. Alvacovius contacted the boys to see if they wanted to re-release some of their old soft disk games. The company, he told them, was having trouble recovering since their departure. They turned him down. More notably, the game turned out Romero's stepfather, John Schunemann. On a trip to Dallas, Schunemann sat across the table from Romero at a dinner at Outback Steakhouse and, for the first time, opened his heart. "You know, I've been a bear sometimes," he said, "but I'm a man. And I remember telling you if you were going to make your mark, you had to do business applications. Well, I want you to know that I'm man enough to admit that I was wrong. I think this is great, and I want you to know I was wrong." Romero accepted the apology. Times were moving on, and there was no reason to hold a grudge. Doom was about to be finished. The best was yet to come. It was Halloween, 1993, and Romero was inside Doom. He stood in a small room with gray walls stained in brown sludge, staring down the barrel of his pistol. An ominous deep synthesizer chord buzzed, giving way to the eerie plucking of a guitar, and finally, a death rattle drumbeat. A shotgun lay on the floor. Romero ran forward, grabbing it and storming through a door that slid open to the ceiling. The snarls resounded from everywhere, hideous snorts and belches and groans. Suddenly there were fireballs, big, red, explosive bursts hurling in flames through the air. He had to act fast. Romero spun once, unleashing his shotgun blast into the chest of a former human, who went flying back in a spray of blood. A fireball sailed into Romero's side, bleeding his vision red until he could hear himself wheezing and panting. Another blast, Romero spun, but he couldn't see anything. A blast again, more wheezing. a shadowy beast the color of television static, hurled forward. Romero fired once to no avail. Then he saw the barrels, two green heaps of waste. The beast was heading right for them. At the perfect moment, Romero fired into the barrel, leaving the monster in a bloody pile of jibs. A door opened, the one in Romero's office. Romero snuck a peek over his shoulder and kept playing as Carmack walked in. Carmack liked what he saw on screen. Romero had a real sense of grandeur, he thought, the way his levels were so diverse, so varied in elevation, so deep. He made his technology sing. "What's up?" Romero asked. Carmack told him that he had enough stuff done to be able to get to the networking part of Doom. Oh, yeah, Romero thought. The networking. They had mentioned this in their press release in January, the fact that Doom would have a multiplayer component, which would let players compete with and against each other. But after all the other work, the networking had become almost an afterthought. Carmack told Romero about what he thought were somewhat modest technical challenges. "So, what I have to do is write the setup stuff to figure out how to communicate over the IPX properly," he said. "And getting the serial stuff going may be a little bit of work." Romero nodded as Carmack spoke. How incredible networking would be, he mused. There had been other games that let players compete head-to-head, side-by-side fighting games like Street Fighter II and this new game called Mortal Kombat were already the rage. And there were seemingly ancient games like the multiplayer colonization game Mule, or Multiple-Use Labor Element, and the early Star Trek-inspired modem-to-modem game, NetTrek. But there had been nothing like a multiplayer Doom. First-person, fast-action, immersive, bloody? Romero's heart raced. He nailed the key on his keyboard and ran through the level on his screen, E1M7, or Episode 1, Map 7. He came to an area down one hall that had a long window opening up to an outside platform oozing with green plasma. Romero imagined two players shooting rockets at each other, their missiles sailing across the screen. "Oh my God," he thought, "no one has ever seen that in a game." Sure, it was fun to shoot monsters, but ultimately, these were soulless creatures controlled by a computer. Now gamers could play against spontaneous human beings. Opponents who could think and strategize and scream. We can kill each other. "If we can get this done," Romero said, "this is going to be the fucking coolest game that the planet Earth has ever fucking seen in its entire history." Carmack couldn't have said it better himself. Within 2 weeks, Carmack had two computers networked to each other in his office. One represented his first-person point of view. The other represented the other players. On cue, he hit the button on his keyboard. His character moved forward on the computer in front of him. He pictured the little packets of data traveling across the network line, flowing into the computer across his office, translating instantly into the space marines on screen. The computers were talking to each other, and Carmack knew the result. He glanced over at the computer to the right and saw his character, now represented in third person, running across that screen. He had made a consensual virtual world, and it was alive. Romero flipped when he came into the office. "Oh my God," he screamed. "That is so awesome!" He dashed back into his office, and Carmack started the game again, this time with Romero connected from his own machine. Romero watched as the Space Marine Carmack controlled ran down a hall. Romero chased after him, unleashing a shot from his gun. Boom! Sending Carmack flying back through the air in a spray of blood and screams. "Suck it down!" Romero cried. Soon, everyone in the company was taking turns in multiplayer mode, chasing each other, hurling off explosions. The office filled with screams, not just digital screams, but real screams, human screams. It was an arena, and they were all in it, competing, running, escaping, killing. They began playing one-on-one matches as well, keeping score manually to see who racked up the most kills. And that was not all, Romero realized. Since they could have four people in a game at one time, why not have them playing cooperatively, moving through a level of monsters as a team? Carmack said it was possible. Romero couldn't contain himself. "Don't tell me you can have a four-people co-op game in here mowing through the monsters," he gasped. "That is the shit!" Romero paced. This was big, bigger than the Dangerous Dave moment, bigger than anything he'd seen. He made his way down the hall, the yelps and screams coming from inside the rooms. There was Adrian, twitching and convulsing as he played against Kevin and Carmack and Jay. What was this? Romero thought. It was like a match, like a boxing match. But the object wasn't just to knock the other guy out or some wimpy shit like that. This was like kill the guy. This was a match to the death. He stopped cold. "This," he said, "is death match." By the first week of December 1993, the work on Doom was hurtling to a close. People had stopped going home, choosing instead to sleep on the couch, the floor, under desks, in chairs. Dave Taylor, hired to help with supplementary programming, had developed quite a reputation for passing out on the floor. But it wasn't happening just because he was tired, he said. Doom was having some kind of greater effect on him, some biological effect. The longer he played, the faster he cruised through the streaming corridors, the more his head would spin. After a few minutes, he would have to lay down on the floor to steady himself. Sometimes he'd just end up falling asleep. It got to be such a frequent display that late one night, the rest of the guys took a roll of masking tape and taped a body outline around him. The pressure mounted as they felt the game approach completion. Random gamers began calling the office and leaving messages like, "Is it done yet?" or "Hurry up, motherfuckers!" Others spewed resentment at id for not meeting its originally promised release date of the third quarter of 1993. "You started posting hype about Doom several months ago," one gamer posted on an online news group. "You've been encouraging us to go ballistic over how great Doom is going to be, and you've told a lot of people that the third quarter of 93 was the date. Now all that anticipation is going to backlash in a massive spurt of flames and ranting against id." Some posted more forgiving tales of anticipatory dreams based on early screenshots released of Doom. "I was firing the shotgun at a pixelated, yes, my dream was pixelated, demon," wrote one gamer. "When my alarm clock went off," well, it turned the radio on, "time to schedule an appointment with a local shrink. I can't imagine what shape I'll be in once the game is actually released." Another wrote a poem called "The Night Before Doom." "'Twas the night before Doom, and all through the house, I had set up my multiplaying networks, each with a mouse. The networks were strung with extra special care in hopes that Doom soon would be there." The publisher of a computer magazine had a darker vision he printed in an editorial called "A Parent's Nightmare Before Christmas." "By the time your kids are tucked in and dreaming of sugar plums, they may have seen the latest in sensational computer games, Doom." On Friday, December 10th, it was finally Doom time. After working for 30 straight hours testing the game for bugs, id was ready to upload the game to the internet. A sympathetic computer administrator at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, named David Dada, volunteered to let id upload the Doom shareware to a file transfer site he maintained on the school's network. It was a good deal. The university, like most, had high-speed bandwidth for the time, which meant it could accommodate more users. The plan was that id would upload the shareware on queue. Then the gamers could download it and transfer it around the world. So much for high-price distribution. The gamers would do all the work for id themselves. Jay had announced the day before in the chat rooms that Doom would be available at the stroke of midnight on December 10th. As the midnight hour approached, the id guys gathered around Jay's computer. The office was littered with the debris of Doom's creation. Adrian and Kevin's clay models sat on the shelves. Heaps of broken chairs and keyboards were strewn on the floor. A busted garbage can crumpled in the corner. The taped outline of Dave Taylor's body collected dust bunnies on the floor. Jay had the Doom file ready to go. Online, the Wisconsin File Transfer Protocol, FTP, site teemed with gamers. Though there was no way for them to communicate through a discussion board or chat room, they had ingeniously found another way to talk. The system had a means that allowed a person to create and name a file that would join another list of files on screen. Someone got the bright idea to talk simply by creating a file and assigning a name like "When is Doom?" or "We are waiting." Hundreds more waited in a special channel of internet relay chat through which people could have real-time discussions in text, where Jay was dropping clues about Doom's coming arrival. Finally, the clock struck midnight. They would have to wait no more. Jay hit the button to upload it to the world. Everyone in the office cheered. But Jay was silent. He sat wrinkling his forehead and tapping his keyboard. There was a problem. The University of Wisconsin FTP site could accommodate only 125 people at any given moment. Apparently, 125 gamers were waiting online. Id couldn't get on. Jay phoned David Dada in Wisconsin and hatched a plan. David would extend the number of possible users so Jay could upload Doom to the machine. And he would stay on the phone with Jay to tell him the precise moment so Jay could be sure to get on. Everyone waited. They could hear the guy typing on the other end of the phone. Then he cleared his throat. Jay's finger hovered over the upload key. "Okay," David said. "Now!" But Jay still couldn't get on. Jay booted up the chat channel, which was filled with gamers. "Look," he typed to them, "I'm sorry, but we have to kick you all off of the Wisconsin site because I can't get this uploaded. And your choices are either I kick you all off and I get this done, or it doesn't get uploaded at all." They scurried off. Jay hit the button one last time and connected. Doom was finally on its way out. Elated but exhausted, the team said their goodbyes and went home for their first good night's sleep in months. Only Jay stayed behind to watch the game finish uploading. After a half hour, the final bit of Doom data made its way to Wisconsin. The moment it did, 10,000 gamers swamped the site. The weight of their requests was too much. The University of Wisconsin's computer network buckled. David Dada's computer crashed. "Oh my God," he stammered to Jay over the phone. "I've never seen anything like this." Neither had the world. Chapter 10. The Doom Generation. Like a lot of parents in 1993, Bill Anderson knew exactly what his 9-year-old son wanted for Christmas: Mortal Kombat. The home version of the violent arcade fighting game was the hottest thing going, eclipsing even Street Fighter II with over 6.5 million sales. Anderson lamented about the game to his boss, an ambitious Democratic senator from Connecticut named Joseph Lieberman. Senator Lieberman listened intently to his chief of staff. He wanted to see the game for himself. Mortal Kombat defied his imagination. Secret moves let players rip the spines from their opponents in gushes of blood on screen. More distressing to the senator, gamers seemed to prefer the brutality. The more graphically gory version of Mortal Kombat for the Sega Genesis home video game system was outselling a blood-free version for the Super Nintendo Entertainment System 3-1. The success of the Sega version had dealt a staggering blow to Nintendo, which had demanded that the developer of the game, Acclaim, remove the controversial death moves to adhere to the company's family values. By choosing to release the Blood and Guts version, Sega became the new must-have system, racking up nearly 15 million units in sales. Nintendo's squeaky clean perch, for the first time in the industry's history, was gone. And this wasn't the only such game. Senator Lieberman came across Night Trap, a big-budget title for the new Sega system that included live-action footage of scantily clad sorority girls, including one played by Dana Plato, former child star on the TV show Different Strokes, being attacked by vampires. Violent films like Reservoir Dogs and Terminator 2 had conquered Hollywood. Now, an edgier, more aggressive video game age seemed to be dawning, too. On December 1, 1993, Senator Lieberman called a press conference to blow the whistle. Beside him sat Democratic Senator Herb Kohl of Wisconsin, chairperson of the Subcommittee on Juvenile Justice and chair of the Subcommittee on Government Regulation and Information. Senator Lieberman was also joined by a somber Captain Kangaroo, the children's television host, Bob Keeshan. Kohl said, "The days of Lincoln Logs and Matchbox cars have been replaced by video games complete with screams of pain that are enough to give adults nightmares." Keeshan warned of the lessons learned by a child as an active participant in violence-oriented video games. Lessons the thinking parent would shun like a plague. Indeed, it could become a plague upon their house. He urged game developers to understand their role in a nurturing society. Senator Lieberman took it as a call to arms. "After watching these violent video games," he said, "I personally believe it is irresponsible for some in the video game industry to produce them. I wish we could ban them." This wasn't the first time that America's political and moral establishment had tried to save youth from their own burgeoning culture. Shortly after the Civil War, religious leaders assailed pulp novels as Satan's efficient agents to advance his kingdom by destroying the young. In the 20s, motion pictures were viewed as the new corrupter of children, inspiring sensational media effects research that would be cited for decades. In the 50s, Elvis was shown only from the waist up on television. Mad Magazine's publisher William Gaines was brought before Congress. In the 70s, Dungeons and Dragons, with all its demons and sorcery, became associated with Satanism, particularly after a player enacting the game disappeared under the steam tunnels of a Michigan university. In the 80s, heavy metal artists like Judas Priest and Ozzy Osbourne were sued for allegedly invoking young listeners to commit suicide. In the 90s, video games were the new rock and roll, dangerous and uncontrolled. This sentiment was a long time coming. The roots were in the 30s, when pinball arcades were thought to be havens for hoodlums and gamblers. New York City Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia placed a ban on pinball that lasted until the mid-70s. By then, the controversial arcade game Death Race, which featured players driving over pedestrian-like stick figures, had made headlines. As the golden age of arcade and home video games exploded into a $6 billion industry in the early 80s, concerns over the potential ill effects on children exploded. In 1982, the National Parent Teacher Association issued a statement decrying game arcades. "The PTA is concerned over the increasing number of video game sites, which may have an adverse effect on many of the young people who frequent such establishments. Initial studies have shown that game sites are often in close proximity to schools. In many cases, there is not adequate control of access by school-age children during school hours, which compounds the problem of school absenteeism and truancy. Where little or no supervision exists, drug selling, drug use, drinking, gambling, increased gang activities, and other such behaviors may be seen. Cities including Mesquite, Texas, Bradley, Illinois, and Snellville, Georgia, began to restrict or ban access to arcades. Children are putting their book fees, lunch money, and all the quarters they can get their hands on into these machines, said Bradley's mayor in 1982, after he saw hundreds of teenagers smoking marijuana in a video arcade in a nearby town. Though the Supreme Court overturned the bans following the Mesquite incident, countries including Malaysia, the Philippines, Singapore, and Indonesia not only banned video games, but shut down arcades. The media began to stoke the flames with headlines like, "Video games, fun or serious threat?" in U.S. News and World Report, and "Video game fever, peril or payoff for the computer generation?" in Children's Health. "The video game craze," said the newscaster Robert McNeil on PBS, "is it warping young minds or educating them for the future?" Scientists, academics, and various pundits struggled to come up with the answers. C. Everett Koop, the U.S. Surgeon General, fired a sensational salvo when he stated that video games were causing aberrations in childhood behavior. "Children are into the game's body and soul. Everything is zapping the enemy. Children get to the point where they see another child being molested by a third child. They just sit back." Newsweek reported on others following suit. Dr. Nicholas Pott, who treats two such patients at a clinic at North General Joint Disease Hospital in New York, says disturbed youths may dodge reality and human contacts, as well as meteorites. The clinic director, Dr. Hal Fishkin, objects to the repeated kill or be killed theme. "We don't need more fodder for the violence mill," he says. Others worry about subliminal messages that the media may transmit. "The more you can titillate your emotions, the less tolerant and patient you are going to be for things that don't deliver as fast," says Fred Williams, professor of communications at the University of Southern California. Despite the assertions, not all academics found substantiation for the damaging effects of video games. There is no evidence to indicate that the games encourage social isolation, anger, antisocial behavior, and compulsivity, concluded the Journal of Psychology. Sherry Turkle, a sociologist at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, praised video games' ability to provide encouragement to emotionally disturbed or retarded children. "A lot of kids who are good at this are not good at other things," she said. "This mastery experience is very important." But when the video game industry bloated and crashed in 1983, so did the rhetoric, for the time being. 10 years later, on the morning of Thursday, December 9th, 1993, Senator Lieberman reignited the cause with the first federal hearings on violent video games. The hearings were filled with impassioned statements by expert witnesses who decried the new scourge. Dr. Eugene Provenzo, a professor who authored a book called Video Kids: Making Sense of Nintendo, proclaimed that video games are overwhelmingly violent, sexist, and racist. Robert Chase, president of the National Education Association, suggested that games incite real-life violence. "Because they are active rather than passive, video games can do more than desensitize impressionable children to violence," he said. "They actually encourage violence as the resolution of first resort by rewarding participants for killing one's opponents in the most grisly ways imaginable." Later, Howard Lincoln, the executive vice president of Nintendo of America, and William White, vice president of marketing and communications for Sega of America, took their brawl over Mortal Kombat to the stage. Lincoln portrayed Nintendo as the martyred defender of family values. White argued that the industry was simply growing up, with more and more games being played by people over the age of 18. Lincoln bristled at that notion. I can't sit here and allow you to be told that somehow the video game business has been transformed today from children to adults, he said to the panel. It hasn't been. After much debate and media fanfare, the hearings ended at 1:52 p.m. on December 9th. Senator Lieberman declared that the video game industry had 1 year to develop some kind of voluntary rating system, or the government would step in with its own counsel. He would call a follow-up meeting in February to determine how the publishers and developers were coming along. The gamers had been warned. It was time to change their ways. The next day, id Software released Doom. 200 feet under Waxahachie, Texas, inside the U.S. Department of Energy's superconducting supercollider laboratory, Bob Mustaine flew back in his chair. The government man was terrified. He wasn't the only one. Across the room, his colleagues also twitched and screamed. This had become a daily occurrence at lunchtime. In all their days studying particle physics at the country's most ambitious research facility, they had never seen anything quite as shocking as the fireballs erupting on their computer screens. Nothing, not even the multi-billion-dollar subatomic shower of colliding protons, blew them away like doom. Several states away, in Fort Wayne, Indiana, a crowd of students convulsed in the computer lab of Taylor University. Brian Iserloh, a gifted math student who worked as the lab supervisor, had once again unlocked the doors earlier that night to let the mob of gamers in. The lab, like most around the country, sported the fastest computers available. As a result, he and the other computer enthusiasts had been skipping sleep, class, and food to sit in front of their PCs playing the game. As programmers, they were awed by the graphics, the speed, the three-dimensional views. And as regular dudes, they had never chased each other down with shotguns before. "Oh my God," Brian exclaimed, checking the clock. "It's 7 a.m. again." That semester, Brian, previously an A student, would get all Fs. A few thousand miles away, Nine Inch Nails rock star Trent Reznor sauntered off a concert stage as the crowd roared. Security guards rushed to his side. Screaming groupies pushed backstage. Trent nodded and waved, heading back through the crowd. He didn't have time for this. There were more important things waiting. He stepped onto his tour bus, forsaking the drugs, the beer, the women, for the computer awaiting him. It was time again for doom. Scenes like these had spread around the world since the game crashed the University of Wisconsin's network on December 10th. Without an ad campaign, without marketing or advance hype from the mainstream media, Doom became an overnight phenomenon in an online domain that, as fate would have it, was simultaneously beginning to explode. Though a global network of computers had been around since the 1970s, when the U.S. government's Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, or DARPA, linked networks of computers, the DARPANET and, later, the Internet, together around the world, it was just starting to seep into the mainstream. This evolution began in 1989, when a computer researcher in Europe named Tim Berners-Lee wrote a program that linked information on the Internet into what was called the World Wide Web. 4 years later, in 1993, two University of Illinois hackers named Mark Andreessen and Eric Bina created and released Mosaic, a free browser program that transformed the web's unseemly data into more easily digestible, magazine-like pages of graphics and text. With this new user-friendliness online, commercial services such as CompuServe and America Online helped court the masses. Among the earliest pioneers, not surprisingly, were gamers, the same ones who had been on online discussion groups and bulletin board systems like Software Creations for years. And all of them, it seemed, wanted to play Doom. Schools, corporations, and government facilities blessed with fast computers, high-speed modems, and, most important, people familiar enough to make them work, were overtaken by the game. Sometimes, literally. Over the first weekend of Doom's release, computer network slowed to a crawl from all the people playing and downloading the game. Eager gamers flooded America Online. It was a mob scene the night Doom came out, said Debbie Rogers, forum leader of AOL's game section. If we weren't on the other side of a phone line, there would have been bodily harm. Hours after the game was released, Carnegie Mellon's computer systems administrator posted a notice online saying, "Since today's release of Doom, we have discovered that the game is bringing the campus network to a halt. Computing Services asks that all Doom players please do not play Doom in network mode. Use of Doom in network mode causes serious degradation of performance for the player's network, and during this time of finals, network use is already at its peak. We may be forced to disconnect the PCs of those who are playing the game in network mode. Again, please do not play Doom in network mode." Intel banned the game after it found its system swamped. Texas A&M erased it from its computer servers. Doom was such a problem that a computer lab supervisor at the University of Louisville created a special software to remedy the problem. "People sprint in here falling all over each other to play the game," he said, "so we have a nice little program that goes through the system and deletes Doom." Early reviews echoed the gamers' glee. PC Week called Doom a 3D tour de force. Compute said it signaled a new era in computer gaming. "The once dull PC now bursts with power. For the first time, arcade games are hot on the PC. The floodgates are now open." Others expressed a mix of shock and allure at the game's unprecedented gore and brutality. "The follow-up to Wolfenstein 3D is even more brilliant, but even more disgusting," wrote a reviewer for The Guardian of London. "This is not a game for children or anyone sensitive to violence." As another explained, "This game is so intense and so genuinely frightening that the deeper you venture into these shadowy chambers, the closer your nose gets to the screen, an indication, I believe, of how much you, the player, enter this adventure game's other reality." Despite the pleas of his wife, the reviewer couldn't keep himself away. Doom was, he confessed, a cyber opiate. It was also a cash cow. The day after Doom's release, id saw profit. Even though only an estimated 1% of people who downloaded shareware bought the remaining game, $100,000 worth of orders were rolling in every day. Id had once joked in a press release that they expected Doom to be the number one cause of decreased productivity in businesses around the world. Their prophecy was true everywhere, it seemed, including their own. "Good night, monkey," Romero yelled. "You better fucking hop down. Fuck you, motherfucker. Suck it down." Sean Green hunched over his computer at id, his sweaty hand twitching his mouse as this barrage of insults screamed through the wall. Ostensibly, Sean had been hired to handle tech support for Doom, but it wasn't long before a more demanding job, sparring partner, took over. With the bordering office, he was regularly challenged by Romero, the ultimate gamer, the surgeon, as Tom Hall had christened him back in the Wolfenstein days, to a round of Doom Deathmatch. Sean had quickly subsumed and surpassed Tom's role as Romero's sidekick and gaming pal, and now, to his shock, he was paying the price. "Come on, monkey fuck!" Romero screamed, pounding his fist on the wall. "Who's your fucking daddy? Let's go!" Sean checked his watch. It was 8 p.m. Again. "Holy shit," he thought. "Another day wasted playing Deathmatch." The games with Romero were taking over everything. Work time, play time, meal time, bedtime. And now, Romero was turning this into a deranged sport, hurling insults like a trash-talking jock after school. The most aggressive thing people usually did when they played video games was roll their eyes. But Doom, Sean realized, called for something more. After winning the next round, he punched the wall back and screamed, "Eat that, motherfucker!" Romero cackled approvingly. This was how games were meant to be played. The violent revelry was not limited to Romero. Office destruction was even more a part of daily life. Keyboards smashed against tables. Old monitors crashed into the floor. The influx of sample America Online discs and computer sound cards ended up embedded like Chinese throwing stars in the walls. One day, even Carmack joined in the action. This happened after Romero accidentally locked himself in his office. Hearing the pleas, Carmack gave the knob a twist, paused, then deduced the most obvious and immediate solution. "You know," he said, "I do have a battle axe in my office." Carmack had recently paid $5,000 for the custom-made weapon, a razor-edged hatchet like something out of Dungeons & Dragons. As the other guys gathered around chanting, "Battle axe! Battle axe! Battle axe!" Carmack chopped Romero free. The splintered door remained in the hall for months. Id was on a high. Though Doom had not penetrated the mainstream like Mortal Kombat or Myst, it was the hottest game in the computer underworld since, well, Wolfenstein and Keen. The guys at Id were the indisputable rulers of the shareware market, heading toward a year of multi-million dollar earnings. And that, they soon discovered, was just the beginning. With the help of a New Yorker named Ron Chimowitz, they were going to conquer retail. Like the Id guys, Ron had hustled his way into the computer industry. Short, balding, and in his 40s, he entered the entertainment business by launching the industry's first Hispanic record label in Miami in the 80s. His big coup was to sign an up-and-coming bar mitzvah band called Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine. He also broke Julio Iglesias in the United States. Naming his company Good Times, he pursued the emerging market for home videos with low-priced 29-minute workout tapes starring Jane Fonda. This product landed him a big deal with the Walmart chain, whose executives urged him to explore what they thought was another virgin marketplace, budget computer software. Ron expanded his company into Good Times Interactive, or GTI. Good Times Interactive first published a Richard Simmons Deal Emil CD-ROM and a Fabio screensaver. But that was hardly enough to fill Walmart's shelves, so Ron went looking into the computer game world. At first, he cut deals with well-known publishers like Electronic Arts and Broderbund to repackage previously released games that had outlived their shelf life. What would be more lucrative, he realized, would be to publish his own budget games. To do this, he needed budget developers, untapped by the Electronic Arts of the world. He found them in shareware. Shareware makers were like a farm league, he thought. He just needed to find the right team to release a retail product. Id Software, he discovered, had done gangbusters with Wolfenstein 3D, and now was causing an even greater firestorm underground with Doom. Yet Doom, to his amazement, had no retail representation. Ron had found his next Gloria Estefan. After flying to Texas to meet with the young millionaires at Id, he was surprised to find a group of long-haired kids in shorts. The office was trashed with broken computer parts, rancid pizza boxes, and an artillery of crushed soda cans. But these appearances belied a true business savvy, Ron quickly learned. After he gave the guys the big pitch about his company and his exclusive deal to shelve 2,200 Walmart stores, Id played it cool. The guys knew that by selling shareware, they were able to eliminate all middlemen and get full dollar value for their product. Furthermore, after the lackluster performance of the Spear of Destiny retail game, they weren't about to throw the shareware model away. Why, they wanted to know, did they need GTI? Ron didn't relent. "Look," he said, "maybe you'll sell 100,000 copies of Doom in shareware, but I believe if you give me a retail version of Doom, and let's call it, for lack of a better term, Doom 2, I think I could sell 500,000 or more units." Id remained unmoved. Ron went back to New York, but returned to Texas two more times to plead his case. Finally, they told him their terms. If they were going to do retail, they didn't want to be treated like ordinary developers. They wanted complete creative control. They wanted to own their intellectual property. And they wanted to be featured prominently on all the merchandise so that people would know the game was coming not from GTI, but from id. Ron agreed and committed to a marketing budget of $2 million for Doom 2. $2 million was more than id had spent to develop all its games combined. Doom, despite its success, was still relegated to the computer underground. Doom 2, which they started working on immediately, would take the mainstream. For id, Doom 2 also fit into the now established and unique formula of putting out a retail product based on a shareware release, just as they had done following Commander Keen and Wolfenstein 3D. It was the best way to milk Carmack's new graphic engines for all they were worth. Doom 2 would simply be a new set of levels built with the original Doom engine. While the artists and level designers worked on the sequel, Carmack could be free to research his next great graphic engine. With the influx of cash from Doom and the promise of Doom 2, the guys didn't wait long to start spending their money. They were philanthropic. Adrian bought his mother a new house in a safer neighborhood than where she'd been living. Romero gave his car, a Cougar, to the manager of a local Mexican restaurant he frequented and paid for a Las Vegas vacation for his grandparents. Carmack bought $3,200 of computer equipment for his former computer teacher at Shawnee Mission East Grade School. "I wanted to buy them things that will allow them to explore other areas," he said, "not just what's in books." He also put aside $100,000 to bail an old high school friend out of jail. Mainly, though, the guys at id spent money on their cars. Kevin bought a Corvette. Adrian bought the Trans Am sports car he'd always wanted. Dave Taylor got an Acura NSX. The guys even chipped in and bought a new leather couch for the office. So, in part, Dave could have something nice to pass out on next time he got what was now widely known as Doom-induced motion sickness. Carmack and Romero themselves celebrated by going Ferrari shopping. At a showroom, they admired a gleaming new Testarossa that listed at $90,000. Carmack was treating cars like he treated his games. He had already grown somewhat tired of his current engine. What he really wanted was one of these. "Oh my God," said Romero. "Holy shit. Now that is a car. That is fucking daddy car right there. Dude, I can't believe you're getting that car." Carmack paid cash for a red one to match his 328. Romero bought a fly yellow Testarossa for himself. They parked them side by side in id's lot, just in the right place so that during work they could gaze down at their ultimate machines. But Carmack's Ferrari didn't stay in the lot for long. Within days, he drove it over to Norwood Autocraft and started on the modifications. He wanted to get the car, which ran at 400 horsepower, at least twice as strong. Bob Norwood, who had become Carmack's automotive mentor, had a master plan: to install a twin turbo system that would not just double, but triple the car's horsepower. For added energy, they put in a computer-controlled device that would inject a burst of nitrous oxide. While Romero was enthralled enough by the pure aesthetics of the Ferraris, for Carmack, the cars were now less means of a joyride than new engineering materials to be modified to his liking. As the id guys soon discovered, Carmack wasn't the only gamer who liked getting under the hood. "Hey," Romero told Carmack one day at the office, "there's something you have to see." He booted up Doom, or at least what was supposed to be Doom, on his computer. Instead, the trumpeting theme of the Star Wars movie began to play. The screen filled with not Doom's familiar opening chamber, but instead a small, steel-colored room. Romero hit the space bar and a door slid open. "Stop that ship!" a voice commanded from within the game. Carmack watched as Romero jolted down the hall past bleeping droids, white stormtroopers, laser guns, the deep bellows of Darth Vader. Some hacker had completely altered Doom into a version of Star Wars. Wow, Carmack thought. This is going to be great. We did the right thing, after all. The right thing was programming Doom in such a way that willful players could more easily create something like this, Star Doom, a modification or mod of their original game. It was an idea hatched after seeing the early modifications that players were creating for Wolfenstein 3D. That small phenomenon had caught Carmack by surprise, even though he had long hacked games like Ultima himself. The Wolfenstein modifications were different, however, because players weren't just finding the code that they could change to increase their character's health. Instead, they were changing their characters altogether, replacing the bosses with Barney. Though Carmack and Romero were intrigued and inspired by these actions, they were concerned over the destructive quality of the mods. Players had to erase the original Wolfenstein code and replace it with their own images. Once a Nazi was changed into Barney, there was no way to bring the Nazi back quickly. For Doom, Carmack organized the data so players could replace sound and graphics in a non-destructive manner. He created a subsystem that separated the media data called WADS, an acronym suggested by Tom Hall. It stood for Where's All the Data? From the main program. Every time someone booted up the game, the program would look for the WAD file of sounds and images to load in. This way, someone could simply point the main program to a different WAD without damaging the original contents. Carmack would also upload the source code for the Doom level editing and utilities program so that the hackers could have the proper tools with which to create new stuff for the game. This was a radical idea, not only for games, but for any media. It was as if a Nirvana CD came with tools to let listeners dub their own voices for Kurt Cobain's, or a Rocky video that let viewers excise every cranny of Philadelphia for ancient Rome. Though there had been some level editing programs released in the past, no programmer, let alone owner, of a company had released the guts of what made his proprietary program tick. Gamers would not have access to Carmack's graphical engine, but the stuff he was making available was more than just subtly giving them the keys. It was not only a gracious move, but an ideological one, a leftist gesture that empowered the people and, in turn, loosened the grip of corporations. Carmack was no longer a boy dreaming of computers in his Kansas City bedroom. He was the 23-year-old owner of a multi-million-dollar company, and he could do whatever the fuck he wanted. He could live the hacker ethic big time. It wasn't a popular way to rule. With the exception of Romero, the only other hacker-minded programmer at id, Carmack's generosity caused much consternation at the company, especially among the more conservative-minded businessmen like Jay and Kevin. "This is a crazy idea," Kevin said. "No one's ever given away their tools to make new content, and we have to worry about legal questions. What if someone takes our content and combines it with their product and releases it? What if someone takes all the content that's developed on the internet and sells it on the shelf, and suddenly we're competing with our own product?" Carmack rolled his eyes. They didn't get this at all, he thought, because they weren't programmers, so they didn't get the hacker joy of it. They weren't really gamers, either. They weren't part of the gaming community that was growing up there. To Carmack's appreciation, Romero came loudly to his defense. "Dudes," Romero told the others, "we're not going to lose that much money. We're making a ton of money right now. Big deal, who cares?" Even before Doom was officially released, plenty of people certainly did care about the ability to modify it. One group was so eager, they hacked the leaked alpha version of Doom. As the official release approached, Carmack had emailed the Wolfenstein mod makers about the new faculties in Doom. He didn't anticipate how far these gamers would go. In only a matter of weeks after Doom's release, hackers began releasing crude level or map editing programs. These tools let players modify existing rooms of the game, say, adjusting walls, moving around floors, or making other minor adjustments. On January 26, 1994, the hackers got all the more real. A student at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand named Brendan Weiber uploaded a free program called the Doom Editor Utility, or DEU. Weiber had created the program with the help of an international online coalition of gamers who, through bone-breaking hack work, had found a way to break apart Doom's code. Though Carmack had provided source code, he gave no clue of how actually to tear the goods apart. The DEU broke everything apart and explained how to make a level from the ground up. Soon, a Belgian student named Raphael Kinet collaborated with Weiber to release a more readable version of the DEU, which hit the net on February 16, 1994. You can do almost anything to any level, they promised in the program. Move, add, or remove monsters and power-ups, change the wall colors and positions, create new lifts, doors, acid pools, crushing ceilings, or even create a new level from scratch. The DEU was a watershed. Suddenly, all those with the gumption could make a level of a game. They didn't need to be programmers or artists or anything. If they wanted, they could just tweak what was there. Or they could dress it up using their own sounds, images, ideas. There could be Doom Barneys, Doom Simpsons, Doom shopping malls, Doom subways. A University of Michigan student named Greg Lewis delved further into the netherworld of Doom code and created a program called DHacked. This software, also distributed for free, did the unthinkable by allowing a user to modify not the WADs containing the graphics, sounds, and levels, but the very core of the game itself, known as the executable file. The executable contained all the technical information for how the game was played, how monsters behaved, how weapons fired, how text was displayed. DHacked is capable of heavily restructuring the way Doom works, Lewis wrote in the file describing his program. Make fireballs invisible. Make missiles do 2,000 points of damage. Make demons float. Edit the ammo tables to help your struggling marine with more ammo. Edit the frame tables and create new-looking items or extra fast-shooting weapons. And save your changes in patch files to distribute to your friends. Create new types of death matches with plasma mines and super-fast wimpy rockets. WAD developers can modify monster types to distribute with their levels. Great new possibilities! Hacker tools for Doom became another means of immersion in what was already the most immersive game around. Doom immersed players in a fast-action 3D world. It immersed competitors in an arena of deathmatching where they could hunt each other down. The Doom mod tools immersed programmers as creators, as ones who could take this incredible world and sculpt it to their own divine desires. The game made them into little gods. Doom hackers began swapping their levels for free in forums on AOL, CompuServe, and across the internet. Gamers who had been failing out of school because of deathmatching now had an even more addictive compulsion, hacking. They hacked all night. They hacked all day. They even hacked naked. At the Taylor University Computer Lab, gamers stripped down for regular skinny hacking parties. Doom wasn't just a game. It was a culture. And it was a culture that made the skeptics within id even more queasy. After much arguing in the company, Jay was granted permission to post legal terms for prospective Doom hackers. Id Software requires no fees or royalties, he posted online. You may require user payment for your work. Your utility must not work with the shareware version of Doom. You must represent that your utility is not an id Software product, and id Software cannot and will not provide support for your product, nor for Doom, after the data has been changed by your product. You may be required to include some legal text in your utility to make our lawyers happy. There may be more, or some of the above may not be in the final document. It depends on my frame of mind at the time. I am sorry to have to resort to the post, he concluded, but there is no other way to keep this process under control. But control at id Software was all the more difficult to be found. By the spring of 1994, id had a new answering machine message. If you are calling to discuss some great idea you have on how you can make money with our product, it said, please press 5 now. As the doom phenomenon grew, the big leagues began to take notice. Universal Pictures, with Ivan Reitman, director of Ghostbusters and Stripes, optioned the rights for a Doom movie. Other companies, including George Lucas's LucasArts, began developing Doom-like games. Even Microsoft, the powerhouse of the industry, was entranced. The company saw Doom as the perfect program to flaunt the bold new multimedia features of its upcoming operating system called Windows. To show off Windows's potential, Microsoft enticed John Carmack to port a short demonstration of the game. The company ended up using the game at the Computer Game Developers Conference to promote the power of the platform. Microsoft is committed to delivering top-notch multimedia functionality in Windows, said Brad Chase, a general manager of the Personal Operating Systems Division at Microsoft. He said games were one of the largest, most important categories of multimedia applications. Soon, however, many began to marvel at how id might make companies like Microsoft or IBM look obsolete. id had taken the shareware phenomenon and transformed it into a recipe for addiction. Doom was so compelling that people just had to have the full dose. Some dubbed it heroinware. Forbes magazine published a gushing article titled Profits from the Underground about how id, in fact, was making companies like Microsoft obsolete. Privately held id Software doesn't release financials, it read, but from what I can flesh out about the company's profit margin, it makes Microsoft look like a second-rate cement company. The writer calculated that id's estimated $10 million in revenues would give them a profit margin that would rival Microsoft's. What happens to this kind of business when the data superhighway arrives? No sales force, no inventory costs, no royalties to Nintendo or Sega, no marketing costs, no advertising costs, no executive parking spaces. This is a new and exciting business model, not just for games and not even just for software, but for a host of products and services that can be sold or delivered via an electronic underground. The mainstream media picked up the ball. The New York Times, USA Today, and Variety, the movie industry's trade magazine, published articles about the business and cultural breakthroughs of Doom. Journalists came to Dallas to see who was behind the phenomenon and reveled in the idiosyncratic world of long-haired gamers and souped-up $200,000 Ferraris. id wasn't just a company that made a killer game. It was the portent of something new, something unseen. Rich, young, creative guys who were bucking all the sensible roots of traditional business for this strange, amorphous thing that at the time was not even widely known as the internet. Everyone is talking about the power of the information superhighway, Jay boasted to the Dallas Morning News. We're the living proof. The industry needed a rock star, he realized. id was it. Like any good rock stars, the company had an air of controversy. Because of the violence, China was considering banning Doom. Brazil, in fact, would later outlaw the game. Even Walmart, which would be the major retail outlet for Doom 2's release, was beginning to balk at the content. But, just as Doom was becoming positioned as the next great scourge of violent games, a safety valve was pulled.